So I wanted to talk some about loving kindness to begin with, and then have us, let us have the experience of actually doing some loving kindness practice, both in walking and in sitting, and then see if there are any questions or comments or anything about what you've actually experienced. But to begin with, I think I'll talk about a kind of schema within which loving kindness fits. And that is when in the Buddhist tradition, action that we take is talked about, whether it's something we say or something that we do, it can be divided into three parts or three aspects. The first and critically important aspect of an action, whatever the action is said to be the intention or the motivation behind the action. What is the heart space that is giving rise to this action? It is so critically important because that's where the energy and the distinctive mark of the action is. The very same activity, handing somebody something, saying something, can be coming from so many different places inside that it actually is a completely different action, depending on what's motivating it. The example I usually use is, say I had a book up here, and I reached out and handed it to one of you. All anybody sees is my hand moving down, picking up an object, and moving it forward. But where is that coming from within me? Maybe I'm offering you the book because I like you, and I want you to have it. Or maybe I'm offering you the book because I see that you have a book I want, and I think, well, hey, if I give you this book, maybe you'll give me that book. Or maybe it's because I'm sitting in front of a whole room full of people and I want everyone to think of me as a remarkably generous person. It's the same action on the surface, but it's also completely different, depending upon the motivation. It's said classically in Buddhism that the intention or the motivation behind an action is where the karmic seed is planted. It's not in, a body part like your hand moving something forward. It's in the heart space that's generating that activity, because that's where you really know what's actually going on. Is it an act of generosity? Perhaps it's not such an act of generosity. Perhaps it's something else entirely. So the world of intention and the habitual intentions that we live from are things we need mindfulness to get more and more in touch with. And it's also said that the field of intention that, generally speaking, guides our actions can be transmuted by practices like loving kindness. There's an actual transformation in that arena of our lives, of our minds. What guides our actions, where we're coming from. And the reason for that is that a practice like loving kindness actually helps change our vision of connection, our sense of the truth of how interdependent we are. It transforms our field of motivation. In fact, when I was not too long ago, I was at a conference with many of the scientists who are doing meditation research these days, and one of the things they said they discovered in putting, say, Tibetan monks into an MRI machine is that when they ask them to do a meditation engendering compassion, the part of the brain that would be fired was the motor part of the brain, because it's an urge to do, an urge to help, to make a difference, to ease suffering. It's not just a feeling or a sentiment. So it's that sense of the field of intention is the arena where practices like loving kindness or compassion specifically work. And I'll come back to that in a minute. The second aspect of an action, as we go along with this model, is the skillfulness or lack of skillfulness with which we act. And this is very much based on a kind of bigger mindfulness or broader mindfulness where we try to pay attention to the context we find ourselves in, feedback, ways we've learned, mistakes we've made, skills we've acquired. So to continue on with that example, maybe out of a beautiful motive, I want to offer one of you a book. But I might pause a moment and say, well, there's only one book. There's a lot of people sitting in this room. Maybe this is the kind of act best done privately. Maybe I should take this person aside, do it in this way. Maybe saying this would be the most skillful way to say what I feel needs to be said. And so it's a lot about wisdom, which is based on this bigger kind of mindfulness. And that's an important distinction to understand between intention or motivation and the skillfulness or unskillfulness of what we do. Because people often confuse the two in a way that implies that if you develop a loving heart, there's this very narrow arena of activity that's available to you. Because that's the only way to have a loving presence in this world. And so the idea seems to be, and it's often a kind of fearful reaction, that were I to develop a loving heart, I would either be kind of stupid or certainly weak, sort of wimpish, and that somebody might hurt or abuse me, and I'll just kind of smile, Because after all, I'm developing a loving heart. And we will, in a similar vein, be able to witness people being hurt or abused or oppressed or tyrannized. And we'll just kind of smile because that's what loving people do. And so there's this sense of not only sentimentality, but a very narrow band in which to live. Constrained by that, confined by that. But it's very important, I think, to see the distinction. I think it's maybe most aptly expressed. Ram Dass's guru, Neem Karoli Baba, who was a great Indian saint, was very famous for saying, you should never throw anyone out of your heart. You should never throw anyone out of your heart. And my friend, my colleague, Sylvia Borstein, has a kind of addendum to that where she says, you should never throw anyone out of your heart. You may throw them out of your life, but never throw them out of your heart. Which, sometimes might be the case. It might be your best guess based on the most global mindfulness or awareness you can bring to a situation that some very fierce action is what's skillful, is what's appropriate. It may not match your preconception of a kindly, loving heart, but it actually might be coming. The intention might be an extremely loving place. But the step, the activity or the action is based on whatever you can discover to the best of your ability as being most skillful. Once, several years ago, I was really sick. I had bronchitis and a lot of relapses of bronchitis. And finally, I was starting to get better. And I was living in New York City. One day I was walking down the street and I heard a woman's voice saying, I've been really sick all winter. So I was naturally intrigued by that. And I turned around and this woman was talking to somebody sitting on the sidewalk, somebody, a street person. And she said, I've been really sick all winter. I've had pneumonia several times. And every time I thought I was getting better, I wasn't. But now I'm finally starting to really get better, and I just wanted to share the joy. And she was giving him a whole bunch of money. And I thought, isn't that interesting? I just walked right by that guy. It never occurred to me for a moment to share the joy. And I thought, should I turn back? You know, should I go up to him and say, you're not going to believe this, but I was really sick too, you know. I'd like to give you a whole bunch of money. But the consideration of whether to offer somebody money or not is one thing. And that is, again, it's like that second aspect of the action based on our estimation of what is skillful and what is unskillful. There's no right or wrong answer. But what was significant to me in that example was that when she walked by that guy, she had some sense that his life had something to do with hers, which I had not. You know, that's the kind of vision of life that that forms our intention. Whether we then go on to act in one way or another way, we don't know. And we needn't consign ourselves to some sense of limitation about that. I think loving motive yields action that's much bigger than that and broader than that and more mysterious than that. So these are the first two aspects, is the intention and the skillfulness or unskillfulness of what we do. And then the third aspect of the action is the immediate result, particularly in terms of praise or blame. Sometimes we give somebody a book or a bunch of money, and they don't seem to thank us in quite the way we assume we should be thanked. And it's interesting, while that first arena of our motivation is something we can use mindfulness to get more and more in touch with, and we can transform through the development of qualities like loving kindness and compassion, the second arena, the skillfulness of our actions, we can learn and grow and change and take in information and become more skillful. This third arena, the immediate result, particularly in terms of praise or blame, is one we actually can't do anything about. But here's the place where we tend to put our hearts and use as a way to assess how well we've done. You know, and so just to continue on with my example, maybe out of this beautiful motive, I decide to give one of you this book, and I wrap it really carefully, and I approach you, I take you aside, I do it privately, I make the offering as skillfully as I possibly can, but, you know, just now, at the end of the walking period, you just used your cell phone and found out that you just won $10 million in the lottery, and you could not care less about this book. You kind of nod distantly, and you know, you walk away, and I'm heartbroken. But what does your reaction mean about my generosity, my offering? Really nothing. But that's not how we usually are. We don't usually have that perspective. Mostly we fall into, well, I'm an idiot. You know, I never do anything right. Why did I choose that stupid book? It was the worst choice. I never do the right thing, you know. Why can't I give better books? And, you know, why did I take them aside and do that? You know, and it's just like, it's that litany of judgment and blame. But really, remember what I said early on in the retreat. Things arise when conditions come together to bring them about. Everything arises due to conditions coming together. None of us has come into this room as a blank slate. We are all joined here because of waves of conditions that have brought us all to this time and place. Each of us. Can you imagine saying to the prospective recipient of your book, something's going to happen at 2 o'clock, so I don't want you to check your cell phone messages, I don't want you to check your email, I don't want you to talk to anybody, and I don't want you to think about anything. You know, just come. as a sort of void. That's not what life is. It's all these conditions coming together in this moment of time. To understand that and to accept that is not complacency, it's wisdom. It means that when we act from as good a motive as we can, with as much skill as we can, and we don't necessarily get the result that we want right now, we have some ability to hold that in wisdom. Say, yeah, that's actually what life is like. That's how it is. It doesn't mean we don't care. I think that would be inhuman. But how much do we care? And where is our awareness? You know, where are we resting for a sense of who we are and how well we've done? How wise is our perspective? That's really the option that we have. Okay, so we have the intention, the skillfulness, and then the immediate result, particularly in terms of praise or blame. And you know, we all know, life is like a continual dance of praise and blame. And the Buddha called the eight vicissitudes of life, of pleasure and pain and gain and loss and praise and blame and fame and disrepute. And he said, this is how it is. This is how it is for everybody. There are ups and there are downs and there are changes, and there's no one who experiences only pleasure and no pain, and no one who experiences only praise and no blame. And I often think it's illustrated so well in those things that we do that elicit both praise and blame from people, even though it's the very same action. And there are, of course, a million examples of that. In the center in Barrie, at IMS, when we opened it in 1976, we had lots of discussions about whether we should have Buddha images around. We happened to have some, largely, I think they belonged to Jack Kornfield, who bought them when he was in the Peace Corps in Thailand. So he'd done a lot of shopping, and we had a lot available to us. And in one way, it seemed like it was inspiring and appropriate, and another way, it seemed, well, you know, this isn't, this whole system, this whole way of practice is not about becoming a Buddhist at all. It's really about using those tools for greater self-understanding. You know, so why should we have a Buddha image around? After all, it's not Asia. We're not in Asia anymore. We're an American. We went back and forth and back and forth, and finally we decided, okay, we'll have the Buddha images because they are very beautiful and they're very inspiring. Now, in Asia, a Buddha image is not considered a work of art. It's a sacred object, and so it's treated with some reverence. You don't usually wear your shoes around a Buddha image, and very classically, when you see one, you bow. You don't, you know, like, you see an ad sometimes now, you know, you don't have a Buddha image with a hat sitting rakishly on his head or something like that, you know. It really is a sacred object. So I remember the year that one of the teachers at IMS decided that they felt like bowing to the Buddha, just like they had done recently in Thailand. And they did that. They came into the hall. They bowed to the Buddha, they sat down, led a sitting, rang the bell 45 minutes later, got up and walked to the bulletin board, which is about the distance from where I'm sitting to the bathroom. By the time they got to the bulletin board, there were notes waiting for them on the board. They pulled the first note off the board and it said, "I was so happy to see you bowing to the Buddha, because I have a very devotional nature as well, and to see that expressed here, you know, made me feel really happy." The second note he pulled off the board said, "I was really appalled to see you bowing to the Buddha. you know, because after all, this is America, it's not Asia, it's a foreign custom, why are you imposing it on us? Same action, 30 seconds later, after ringing the bell, some people liked it, some people didn't like it. It's inevitable. I'm not suggesting that we ignore every comment that comes our way of blame or displeasure. Sometimes those are a great call to look at our intention, to look at our level of skillfulness. But the kind of heartache that we experience through the identification, I'm all bad, you know, I got blamed for something, completely overlooking our motivation or our level of skillfulness. Or the exaltation we feel when we get praise, oh, it's going to be this way forever. You know, this is a good world. They liked my book. You know, it's so unreal. In fact, when Faith came out in hardcover, I was in San Francisco somewhere in that period at the airport about to fly back to Massachusetts. And I checked my messages from the airport back home. Someone had left me a message saying, did you know your book was reviewed in the Boston Globe today? Which I hadn't known. And then he went on to say, it was really a positive review except for those few disparaging remarks. And that was all he said. So I got on the airplane and for 6 hours, all I could think was, what disparaging remarks were those? You know, the whole rest of the sentence was gone. Like, I couldn't remember that at all. And then, of course, the first thing that happened when I landed was that I grabbed a copy of the Boston Globe, and sure enough, it was a generally positive review with some very disparaging remarks in it. But life's like that. It's the nature of things. So I'm not counseling indifference, but wisdom. Okay, so that's the basic model. Intention, skillfulness, and the immediate result in terms of praise or blame. The practice of loving kindness or metta is most commonly taught, it's classically taught as part of, as I'm sure you know, many of you, as part of a bundle of three other practices. So altogether there are four, known as the four Brahma-viharas. Brahma meaning sublime or celestial. One translation I heard of it was the word best. Someone recently came up to me at the end of a talk and said that another translation is big in the sense of immense and open. So that's Brahma. Vihara is dwelling or abiding or home. So taken together, these four qualities are said to form our best home. And like any home, we know what it feels like when we're there. It's the place we don't have to pretend to be somebody else. We don't have to put on a kind of persona. It's the place we are at ease, we're comfortable, we're most genuinely and authentically ourselves. So that's our home. The four qualities are, first, loving kindness itself, then compassion, sympathetic joy, and finally, equanimity. These are the four qualities that form our best home, or most immense, open, unconfined, abiding. Loving kindness is the first, is a translation from a word from Pali, metta, M-E-T-T-A. And those of you who have been to the Insight Meditation Society have seen the word metta up above the doorway in big letters, which was also an early object of debate. When we first bought the place, it was owned by the Catholic Church and run by an order called the Fathers of the Blessed Sacrament, which is what it said up above the doorway, Fathers of the Blessed Sacrament. We moved in on Valentine's Day in 1976. We got some poor person to go up in a very tall ladder and said, in very cold weather, and said, could you work with those letters to see if you can come up with an arrangement that means something about us? So he got up in the ladder and was playing around with that and came up with metta. And then the debate ensued. Because again, some people said, well, you know, it's not even English. And, you know, why should we have a foreign word up in the front of the building? And, but I was of the school, which happily prevailed, that really enjoyed it. And the reason I enjoy it so much is that when people call for directions, say the UPS delivery person or somebody like that calls for directions, and we get to say it's a large brick building with white pillars, and it has this word up on top, metta. And then they usually say, what does that mean? And we get to say, that means love. Or that means loving kindness. The translation of metta as loving kindness, I think, is a good translation, but it's a little bit far in a word. You don't necessarily often hear the word loving kindness in casual conversation, and so I think it might make the quality seem a little removed and precious and far away. Sometimes it's translated as love, although that's very complicated, because we use that word in such a wide variety of different ways. Sometimes when we say love, we really frankly mean a medium of exchange. You know, I will love you as long as you thank me for the book, really a lot, you know, or as long as you give me one back, or, you know, as long as you tell me how much you love me, or as long as the following 15 conditions are met. Once I used that example somewhere, and someone in the group called out, only 15? Well, and while, you know, I'm not trying to condemn that state, which is really a kind of attachment, we can sense the fragility of it, the dependence of it on certain conditions being met. And when those conditions are not met, it fades, or it's threatened, or it dissolves. So how sustaining is that if it's that fragile? It's not. So metta means something else, something that isn't going to just go away when we don't get what we want, or we disappoint ourselves when we make a mistake, or things change outside of our control. Probably the closest translation of the word metta is friendship. So it means developing the art of friendship toward ourselves, and not just toward those aspects of ourselves we really like, but those aspects of ourselves we feel a little cut off from or distant from, those aspects of ourselves we don't like so very much. It's having the spirit of friendship nonetheless, and then friendship ultimately toward all of life, which doesn't mean, again, you know, just acquiescing and saying, oh, fine, you know, hit me again or hurt them again. But rather, it's a very deep recognition of the truth of how connected we all are, that that's just in the nature of things. So it's friendship toward ourselves and ultimately toward all of life. Because whether or not we like someone or not, we are literally almost in the same boat. You know, we live in a very interconnected universe. Once I was, I know some of you are going tonight to hear Ram Dass and Krishnadas, and once I was teaching with Krishnadas, who was doing chanting together somewhere. We spent an afternoon in LA teaching together. And it was a beautiful feeling in the room. It was just like filled with love, so that by the end of the day, Krishnadas looked up and said, maybe we should all live together. And then he paused a moment and he said, I guess we do. And don't we? You know, we share this planet, we share this earth, we share this life. That's the spirit of loving kindness, is that recognition. I guess we do, don't we? So that's metta. Metta, more than anything, I think, is a quality of attention or awareness. It's not actually about being flooded with a certain kind of sentiment or warm, gushy feeling. It's about how we pay attention, who we pay attention to, the ways we learn to include rather than exclude, to open to rather than ignore. It's the nature of that kind of practice. And then I'll just quickly go through the other three. Compassion is defined as the trembling or the quivering of the heart in response to pain or suffering. So it's, as Thich Nhat Hanh once said, compassion is a verb. It's the movement of the heart, and apparently the brain, this motor area. That's the nature of compassion. It also gets balanced by wisdom, because there are an awful lot of times we're not going to make the suffering go away. No matter what we want, or no matter how we try. But the state of compassion is the movement toward the opening, the sense of presence with, rather than avoiding or looking the other way or disdaining or trying to deny what's actually going on. And it means, even with ourselves, a kind of translation of our experience. And one of the quotations from the Buddha that's also very famous is when he said, "I teach one thing and one thing only, that is suffering and the end of suffering." It's one of those statements for which Buddhism is mistakenly seen as being quite pessimistic. "I teach one thing and one thing only, that is suffering and the end of suffering." It's not really that it's pessimistic, because first of all, it's not just suffering, it's also the end of suffering. But in addition, there are lots of ways of using that statement. One is clearly that we need to acknowledge and open to and admit the suffering that exists before we can find the end of suffering. And the other is almost as a kind of grid or way of looking at our experience, so that from that perspective, from that point of view, we have certain states, certain forces that arise in our minds that cause suffering for ourselves and for others. And there are other states that are about the end of suffering. So can you imagine for a moment looking at your own jealousy and fear and greed and envy and craving and, you know, that long, long list of states we don't like much. Can you imagine having them come up, and instead of calling them bad and wrong and terrible and horrible and yourself a bad, awful, terrible, horrible person for having had them arise, can you imagine translating that into actually seeing them as states of suffering? It'd be pretty different. And in just that way, you know, states of wisdom and compassion itself and love arise, and we can see them as states that are exemplifying the end of suffering. So when it is the more painful side, you know, greed and jealousy and envy and fear and all of that, imagine not rejecting yourself and not hating yourself and not feeling that this state is the most horrible thing that anyone has ever felt. Imagine seeing it as a state of suffering and feeling the compassion that would just naturally rise in that way. And compassion doesn't mean succumbing, you know, like, take me, greed, you know, where's my credit card? But it means taking whatever action we take from an intention or a motivation of kindness, of care, rather than hatred. Okay, back to the earlier thing I was saying. The motivation is one thing, the skillful action you take is another consideration. So compassion doesn't make us weak. What it does is actually make us feel at one with others, because we spend so much time either avoiding suffering or feeling threatened by our own suffering or other people's suffering, or trying to disguise it or push it away, or disliking ourselves for the pain that we're in and overlooking the pain that others are in, that when we actually take the time to develop the state of compassion, it unites us. Because all of us want to be happy, and all of us are vulnerable to change and to unhappiness and to those vicissitudes of life, pleasure and pain, and gain and loss, and praise and blame, and fame and disrepute. In some ways, we're not so very different. So compassion will arise from that recognition. And the third of the Brahmaviharas is a state known as sympathetic joy. And it's almost the energetic opposite of compassion. If compassion teaches us to open to suffering, sympathetic joy, which means having happiness or rejoicing in the happiness of others, also teaches us to open to joy. The practice of sympathetic joy, or the cultivation of sympathetic joy, means that when we observe someone's success or good fortune, instead of falling sway to that voice which often arises inside of us, which says, ew, you know, I would be happier if you just had a little bit less going for you right now. We actually feel happy for them. The lack of sympathetic joy is usually based on some idea that happiness is a limited commodity in this world, and the more someone else has, the less there's going to be for us. But really, is that so? I think the Dalai Lama said it most cogently, maybe when he said, it only makes sense to develop happiness for the happiness of others, because then you increase your chances of happiness 6 billion to 1. And then he went on to say, those are very good odds. And I thought about that. You know, you don't have to spend any money. You don't have to, like, devise some entertainment. You don't even have to get dressed in the morning. All you have to do is think of someone else's happiness, get happy, and there you are. You know, it's free. Those are very good odds. I think we know the nature and the beauty of that state of sympathetic joy, because we know what it's like when we are receiving it or not from somebody else. You know, when something really good happens for you, and some people are so happy for you, and how beautiful that is, and how wonderful that feels, what a gift it is, and how other people, I mean, they may smile, you know, and they may say congratulations, but you get the very strong feeling that they would be just as happy if you didn't have what you wanted. And how terrible that feels, and diminishing that feels. It's a very powerful trait. The winter before, I very cleverly arranged to spend most of the winter in L.A., instead of Massachusetts, which was having a very fierce and terrible winter. It was 10 below and 15 below. Every time I called home, you know, and they'd say it's 10 below, I was happy to be where I was. And one day I was there staying with a friend of mine who lives in Malibu, right on the ocean. And I had to call back to Massachusetts to change a doctor's appointment coming up sometime in the future, and as I was speaking, the receptionist kept saying she couldn't hear me. So finally I said, well, maybe you can't hear me because I'm in Malibu right by the ocean, and the sound of the crashing waves is drowning out my voice. And she said, "Is that true? Are you really in Malibu?" I said, "Yeah." And she said, "I hate you." I said, "I'm not changing your appointment." She said, "Is that why you want to change your appointment? So you could stay there longer?" You know, so of course she was joking. But how often are we really in that state, whether we say it out loud or not? And imagine the freedom that would come from not feeling diminished or threatened by someone else's happiness, but actually being able to take delight in it. So that's sympathetic joy. Those three states of loving kindness, compassion, and sympathetic joy, as I said, are in the teaching said to transform our field of intention in a way that becomes quite natural. Not that you're in some situation and you have to force yourself to think, well, I want to be more loving, and, you know, I don't really want to be more loving, but I should want to be more loving. And, you know, it's not something self-conscious or manufactured or fabricated, but it's through the genuine cultivation, through the practices, that this is what we see happening. We are coming from a different place in regard to ourselves, in regard to others. Then the fourth of the Brahmaviharas is the state of equanimity, which means balance of mind. It doesn't mean indifference. It doesn't mean callousness. It doesn't mean not caring. It does mean that kind of wisdom I was talking about. It's the wisdom of perspective. It's knowing that however hard we try, we're not going to make all the suffering go away. We're not going to get only praised and never blamed. We're not going to have everybody say nice things to us all of the time. It's not that we don't care, but it's almost like a kind of maturity of saying, yeah, this is how it is. This is outside of my control. And that maturity leads to a measure of peace. The peacefulness or the balance of equanimity doesn't remove us from trying to make a difference. It actually sustains all of our efforts to make a difference. Said that equanimity endows loving kindness with patience, because it's very easy to say, may you be happy according to my agenda and my timetable, so I'd like to see by tonight, you know, these changes, as opposed to may you be happy as a freely given gift, without demand, without expectation. It's said that equanimity endows compassion with courage, because it's not easy to open to suffering, to look at pain or dissatisfaction. We need some balance. If we feel we have to fix it all, that it's up to us, that ultimately we're in control, we're not going to be able to do that. We can't open. It's too much. And it said that equanimity allows sympathetic joy to expand beyond the very narrow group of people we tend to feel comfortable in their happiness, but rather to have it as a more open and generalized state. Because we understand the nature of happiness. We're holding it in perspective. We're able to wish well to others. So we have the first three Brahmaviharas, transforming our intention. Mindfulness allowing us to learn to act more and more skillfully. And equanimity giving us strength and open-heartedness with whatever results may come from our actions. Very often, you can of course do each of those practices of loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity separately, but very often you can do just one of the practices with having the other three threaded throughout, kind of embedded in there. And that's what we tend to do. Usually we choose loving kindness as a practice, and use it to develop all four of these qualities. We do it in sitting, we do it in walking, and I thought actually we could start with walking, which will give you a break and a chance to get out. The practice of loving kindness is done through the repetition of certain phrases, silently. Phrases directed toward ourselves or directed toward others. The phrases are usually really simple. They're big enough or general enough so it's something we can offer to ourselves and then offer to others. So the phrases, the traditional phrases, are things like, may I live in safety, may I be happy, may I be healthy, may I live with ease. And it's not felt like if you say it loud enough and fast enough, you'd never get sick, for example. May I be healthy, may I be healthy. But it's more a sense of giving yourself a gift. The words don't really matter. It's the heart space that they exemplify or embody. We use the words as a way of forming the connection. So we choose certain phrases like that. May I live in safety? May I be happy? May I be healthy? May I live with ease? And just gently repeat them over and over. They become the primary object, the actual phrases. And then when our attention wanders, as it will, we practice the same way. We try to let go and bring our attention back. 10 seconds later, when our minds wander, we do the same thing. We try to let go and bring our attention back. So traditionally, we begin with ourselves, and then we move through various categories of beings in this offering of loving kindness. But since we're going to begin with walking, I'll go right there, and then when we come back and do the sitting, I'll step back and talk about that. In doing walking practice and loving kindness, as I said earlier, you can walk at any pace. It doesn't matter. You don't have to slow down. And I think it's great if you can get outside. Instead of focusing so much on the feeling of the body in movement and the different sensations like we did earlier, instead you focus on the repetition of the phrases. May I be happy? May I be peaceful? Whatever your phrases happen to be. You can use the traditional phrases or anything that makes sense to you, that seems right to you. It doesn't have to be the traditional phrases. So you just walk along, eyes open, with your attention resting on the phrases towards yourself. And then when either you go by somebody, you see somebody, or you hear a bird, or maybe somebody comes strongly to mind, just for a moment, offer the phrases to them. Be happy. And then go back to offering the phrases to yourself. So your primary object is the offering of phrases to yourself, and you include others as they come strongly into your consciousness. You don't necessarily want to try to include all beings because there's a lot of life out there, you know. You'll be kind of scanning. So to have a sense of centeredness, we rely on the phrases for ourselves and then open to others as they walk by, as you hear them, as they have some kind of strong impact on your consciousness. Okay? So we'll try that.